Storylines Midwest, I'm Keith Taylor.
And I'm Charity Nebbe. On upcoming episodes of Storylines Midwest, we'll continue looking at some of the great literature of the Midwest. In upcoming episodes, we'll have Jane Smiley on to talk about her novel, A Thousand Acres. And we'll also have Charles Baxter on to talk about his novel, A Feast of Love.
But today we're talking about the poetry of the Midwest, starting with Carl Sandburg and Gwendolyn Brooks. They both lived in Chicago and both wrote about the lives of people they encountered every day. Here's Gwendolyn Brooks reading the first poem in her first published collection. The poem is called Kitchenette Building.
We are things of dry hours and the involuntary plan. Grayed in and gray. Dream makes a giddy sound, not strong like rent. Feeding a wife, satisfying a man. But could a dream send up through onion fumes its white and violet, fight with fried potatoes and yesterday's garbage ripening in the hall, flutter or sing an aria down these rooms? Even if we were willing to let it in, had time to warm it, keep it very clean, anticipate a message, let it begin. We wonder, but not well, not for a minute. Since number 5 is out of the bathroom now, we think of lukewarm water, hope to get in it.
Gwendolyn Brooks' early work was published by mainstream publishers, and it was enormously successful. But in the late 1960s, she was a part of the Black Arts Movement. She wrote later that she believed that, quote, black poets should write as blacks and address themselves to blacks. Because of her beliefs, she decided to publish her work only with black-owned presses. She made the move to Broadside Press in Detroit.
With us now is Melba Joyce Boyd. She's a poet and chair of the Department of Africana Studies at Wayne State University. In the early 70s, she was assistant editor at Broadside Press, and we'd like to hear from you with your questions about Gwendolyn Brooks, about the Black Arts Movement, also your favorite Midwestern poets. That number again, 866-255-2762. Melba, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to ask you about the beginning of Broadside Press. Now, Dudley Randall founded that in the late 60s. What was his goal in starting the press?
Well, initially, and technically, he founded the press in order to copyright the poem Ballad of Birmingham, which was in response to the bombing of the church in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, because the poem was going to be set to music by a folk singer. And he, in order to protect his rights as the author, he copyrighted it. And he was a librarian by training, in fact, a graduate of the University of Michigan in library science. So he was very much aware of how to take care of these custodial concerns. Well, what happened during the 1960s was this momentum as a response to the civil rights movement and the developing black liberation movement, the black power movement specifically, as we begin to get into the dialogue of black and black as the correct term for the times. What happened at some of these conferences, as was referenced earlier in the case of Gwendolyn Brooks at the 1967 conference, there were also conferences going on all over the country, and in particular in Detroit, there were a number of such conferences. And Dudley Randall was active on the literary scene in Detroit, had been for many years, and his poetry had been published in Negro Digest, for example, which was edited by Hoyt Fuller in Chicago. But again, a lot of people don't know this, but Hoyt Fuller went to Wayne University and grew up in Detroit. So he was very close to Hoyt. In fact, they had been classmates. So Dudley was very close to what was going in the cultural community as well. And there was this call for blacks to become more independent, to develop institutions. And Dudley felt that if indeed there was a need to develop institutions, and what he felt in particular as a poet who had difficulty placing his works, that blacks needed to have their own publishing houses. And so he took the initiative and extending the establishment on the basis of the first Broadside that he copyrighted, and he copyrighted the second one in response to the assassination of President Kennedy, which was also put on the same recording. And he began the Broadside series. And at the 1966 Writers' Conference at Fisk, which was the year before the one that Gwendolyn Brooks attended, he put out a call and asked a number of the writers in attendance, prominent people there, Margaret Walker, Leroy Jones at the time, Melvin B. Tolson, who was teaching at Fisk, Robert Hayden, who was a very old friend of Dudley Randall. They started writing poetry together in the 1930s in Detroit, and they gave their poems to the series, and he began to build the reputation of the press with actually some of these very established writers. And also the first book, which was planned by Broadside Press, was for Malcolm, which he co-edited with Chicago artist Margaret Burroughs. And that was sort of the beginning, and from For Malcolm, there was a sort of a flood of requests from aspiring writers to for him to publish their individual volumes, and that's how it sort of mushroomed.
So when Gwendolyn Brooks came in, there he had several books out already, or at least one book in the Broadsides.
Gwendolyn Brooks' first book was published in 1969. She was very generous with her works. Like I indicated, in the Broadside series, she gave one poem. And after the 67 conference, she was very much caught up in the momentum of the movement. And she decided that she wanted to leave Harper and Row and come to Broadside and to become a part of the movement. But also, in turn, because she was such an important Black writer in the Black community, but also in the larger American literary community, that brought attention to the movement. It brought legitimacy and attention in a manner that, coming from the African-American community as a minority group, in quotes, it's very difficult to impact, you know, the whole country without someone saying, well, why is this very famous Pulitzer Prize-winning poet publishing her books out of this little press in Detroit, Michigan? And that changed, I think, the perspective and interest of the way that we began to look at how poetry should be regarded, and also the importance of small presses.
Did you get a chance to work with her when you were...
I knew Gwendolyn Brooks quite well because she worked very closely with Dudley. She was very instrumental with also directing young writers to the press. I believe it was through Gwendolyn Brooks that Dudley began to communicate with Etheridge Knight. It was through Gwendolyn Brooks that we were able to actually afford to publish Audre Lorde's book that Broadside did, because Dudley was initially, he financed the press out of his pocket, and so we were always in the red. Now, this is a few years before I came to Broadside. I was a student, actually, in college during the late 60s. But Gwendolyn was always around. She was always in Detroit. I spent a lot of time with Gwendolyn Brooks. She was very supportive and encouraging for the young writers. She, of course, worked very closely with the young writers in Chicago at that time, Hakeem Al-Budi, who was Don L. Lee. She's very important and critical to his popularity, and she endorsed and promoted his work. And so her relationship with the press was more than simply that she was a poet who lent her reputation and her work. She was a person who also lent her editorial skills and gave direction and advice to Dudley about which poets he should pay attention to. And oftentimes she would even make contributions to finance the publications of specific works. Again, in the case of Audre Lorde, which was a real important find for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were a young writer at the time. How did you feel about the move that she made?
Well, I was really young. Sometimes when I think about it, it's amazing how young I was. I came to Broadside in 72. I was 22 years old. I had just finished my master's degree at Western Michigan. And I went almost sort of literally from books at a university into working with Dudley at the press. I was very much impressed that she was involved, but it was sort of different from my perspective, because I was young, and of course our generation thought that, well, of course she would want to work at Broadside Press, because this is the most important place to be if you're in poetry. And from my naive perspective, you know, I felt that it just all seemed natural. I didn't know anything different, because I came into the press right in the middle of its success, and it was flourishing, and it was really big, and it was important. So it was different for me in terms of understanding that until, you know, when you get older, you come to understand.
We've been getting some calls here, and you can join our conversation, too, at 866-255-2762. Right now, I'd like to talk to Riley in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hello, Riley. How are you?
Good. I've recently been learning about Jim Gustafson from Detroit, and I don't really know a lot about him. I was wondering if you guys did.
Yeah, Jim was thanks for calling, Riley. Jim was an incredible character. Jim was a larger-than-life character, and he died far too young, and that was partly his own fault. But he wrote some wonderful poems. As a matter of fact, he appears in an anthology our guest Melba Joyce Boyd recently edited. It's published by Wayne State. The anthology is called Abandoned Automobile, and the subtitle is Detroit City Poetry, 2001. Melba, what was the purpose of this anthology? What was your hope for it?
Well, actually, my co-editor, M.L. Liebler, approached me and said, you know, I think we should do a big Detroit anthology. And I said, okay. It sounded like a good idea. And so I certainly can't take full credit even for the idea, because ML was the one who said, I think it's time that we did one. And I really believe that this is probably the most comprehensive collection of Detroit poetry, because we did attempt to make it historical as well as contemporary. And so a lot of the poets who began writing early on, someone mentioned earlier in the show, Robert Hayden, we were sure to include him. We have Dudley Randall, who passed away a couple of years ago, and we have the sort of perspective of Detroit poetry pretty much, I think, the span of the 20th century and coming up out of the swelling of the labor movement and, you know, the change of the city itself, which I think is key to understanding when Detroit begins to develop a literary identity.
And just to finish up on Riley's question, Jim Gustafson was a poet associated with a very large group of people working around Wayne State University in the late 60s and the early 70s, and an enormous dynamic sort of poet who would spin things out.
You're listening to Storylines Midwest, and you can join our conversation at 866-255-2762. Now, we've been talking about Carl Sandburg and Gwendolyn Brooks, and these are people who wrote about urban landscapes, urban environments in their poetry. And I guess, you know, when we think about the stereotypical poet, that's not the kind of thing that the stereotypical poet writes about. And in your collection, there are also a lot of poets writing about this urban landscape. What do you think poets are trying to accomplish or can accomplish when writing about something that's not necessarily classically beautiful, not necessarily classically the subject for poetry?
Well, I think that what is classically poetry probably needs to be redefined, that poets, like any other artist, is generally working out of their environment and are affected by historical as well as spatial impacts on their imagination. If you live in the middle of a city, you're going to reflect those images, because those are the images that are going to have meaning and will be refracted in your language. I think that what's interesting about Detroit writers, and I don't think I'm being unreal here, is that there is, though, a very interesting connection to nature in Detroit writers with regards to the impact of the Great Lakes. The Detroit River figures very prominently in the way that poets talk about their life in Detroit, as well as that contrasted against, you know, the grit and grime of working in factories, you know, living, you know, around the kinds of dynamics that make life rather difficult in any big city on this planet. And I think that that's what's really interesting about Detroit poets, is that they do have, I think, an understanding of the relationship between the land space and the city space. And they do tend to vacillate between those two major poles of experience.
Do you have examples of that in the book? I'd love to hear you read a poem, maybe even part of one of yours, Melba.
Well, part of one. You want to hear part of one of mine?
She's got long poems.
Just because of time, we'd like to hear it all. But.
Well, I think there is a piece by, you want to hear my poem or you want to hear from one of the other poets?
Let's hear part of yours.
You want to hear part of mine. Which one do you want to hear from? Keith, I know you.
Let's do this burial of a building. I think that fits in nicely with some of the things you were just saying.
Okay, this poem, I'll just read the last part of the poem. This was a poem written in response to the implosion of the J.L. Hudson's department store building. And in fact, I wrote this poem in response to my experience of observing that, and I was at a gathering of poets at a poet's house up in a high-rise in downtown Detroit, and this is sort of one of the responses, a part of the response that I had watching the building go down. Did the ghosts follow our footprints to sit atop our houses, or did they hover next to high-rise towers and likewise point translucent fingers and clink champagne glasses filled with misty laughter? Or did the blast call their skeletons to attention, disrupt such earthbound musings, and with the wind scatter them with dust, ashes, and disoriented pigeons? Another landmark gone, another space left behind, another hole in a story, another burial to collect bones, another place from where ghosts are gone.
Thanks, Melba. That's great.
Thank you.
We were talking, we'd mentioned Philip Levine the first half of the hour. Now, Philip Levine is another person who's in your anthology. How long are Phil's poems? They're pretty long, aren't they?
Well, his poems are very long, and there was a reference to Phil earlier, and I did have the pleasure of meeting Philip a few months ago. He was in Detroit giving a monster reading, I must say, at Mary Grove College, and he's just a really wonderful guy and extremely generous with us with regards to his contributions to this anthology. And I would like to read, I think from a wonderful poem, parts of it, with apologies to Phil. I'm sorry, I don't have time to read the whole poem, but for those of you who are interested and I hope motivated will buy the book, and this is from Salt and Oil. For a moment, the energy that makes them who they are shatters the noon's light into our eyes. And when we see again, they are gone and the street is quiet, the day passing into evening. And this is autumn, and in the present year, the third man, you ask, who was the third man in the photograph? There is no photograph, no mystery, only salt and oil. In the daily round of the world, three young men in dirty work clothes, on their way under a halo of torn clouds and famished city birds. There is smoke and grease. There is the wrist's exhaustion. There is laughter. There is the letter C's in the clock and the apple's tang, the river sliding along its banks, darker now than the sky descending, a last time to scatter its diamonds into these black waters that contain the day that passed, the night to come.
That was Melba Joyce Boyd reading from Philip Levine's poem, Salt and Oil, and that poem appears in the anthology she co-edited, Abandoned Automobile, Detroit City Poetry, 2001.
We have a number of people on the line right now who want to talk about their favorite Midwestern poets, and let's see, who's been waiting the longest? Let's talk to Richard in Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Richard.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I've been familiar with Vachel Lindsay for some time, and of course, I was impressed by his colorful personality, and the fact he wore a cape and gave his lectured with his poems, traveled the country, and so forth. And it's hard for anybody to get support when they're a poet, usually, but he was certainly in that category. And at one time, finally, when he died, they tried to raise money for the Vachel Lindsay home, so as not to tear it down. And there were some wealthy men in Springfield. One was a well-known trial lawyer, another was a well-known businessman. They had been football players at Springfield High School, and Vachel Lindsay had been the manager of the football team. And they used to torment Vachel, and they called him Rachel, and that kind of drove him nuts. And in later years, a man approached them to, when Vachel was gone, approached these fellows for donations for the Vachel Lindsay Fund, for the house, and each one gave $5.
Well, Richard, for those of us who might not be familiar with Vachel Lindsay's work, can you name perhaps a couple of his must reads that we can take away from this conversation?
Well, the Congo is a well-known poem, and I hope it lasts for a long time. I think it's a striking poem. I think it'll get more popular in the future, 100 years from now or so, but it's a very strong poem, and, of course, Chinese Nightingale, and he did The Proud Mysterious Cap as a small one.
And one of my favorites is General William Booth Enters Heaven.
Yes.
Booth led boldly with his big brass drum. Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? I love it.
Right.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks a lot. And let's hear next from Greg in Interlochen, Michigan. Hello, Greg.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit first about the relationship between students of poetry and how important that is. Much of the discussion has centered on teaching centers, Wayne State and Detroit and Western Michigan, and being from Interlochen, there's a wonderful faculty here that actually teaches high school students poetry in small groups and short fiction. And I think that relationship is so important, especially when writers are young. So I just wanted to mention that, and also I wanted to, again, second your interest in James Wright. He's from a part of the country where I'm from. He's from Martins Ferry, Ohio, mm-hmm. and I'm originally from Wheeling, West Virginia.
Huh.
And so much of his work really, not only is it so lyrically beautiful, it really strikes a chord in a kind of universal American nature, and particularly the poem Autumn Begins in Martins Ferry, Ohio.
That's quite a poem, isn't it, Greg?
It's amazing.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Greg. There's a couple big things that Greg talked about there. Melba, first of all, since you're still here, and I know you teach poetry, what's the relationship of the poet with the students of poetry?
Well, I think that it's a very key relationship, and poetry, I think, as an art form, and that was also related earlier, poetry in the United States is sort of a very peculiar preoccupation, you might want to say. Everyone wants to be a poet, but at the same time, there doesn't seem to be this sort of fame or import associated with writing poetry, and that's why you have magazines like Poetry Magazine always struggling, small presses always walking on the edge of ending and what mm-hmm. have you. So the relationship between the poet and the poet and the poet as teacher and so on and so forth, I think, is a part of keeping the community going. It's a way of developing. It's a way of bonding. Right now I'm teaching a workshop at the Scarab Club in Detroit, and there's a great group of women writers who are coming together. And the camaraderie, I think, in the poetry community is very important and very real. And you do have to keep the art going by teaching, because I didn't think that we get the kind of support that we need otherwise. And then, of course, as someone mentioned, Paul Engle earlier, I used to teach at the University of Iowa, and that's a big poetry writing place where poets flock. But then you have community poetry writing groups, and I think those are very important for people who are not in a formal educational setting, and they have a lot of important and great things to say.
Well, Melba Joyce Boyd, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Melba Joyce Boyd is the co-editor of an anthology called Abandoned Automobile, Detroit City Poetry 2001. And I want to take Joanna from Holland, Michigan, because she's got a story for us tonight about Carl Sandburg, since we've been talking about him this evening. Hello, Joanna.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, well, out of breath, I'm standing in my hope and no one sees me clothes in my local supermarket.
Well, it's radio, so don't worry.
Yeah, well, I know I'm going to see all my neighbors come in the door any minute now. But I was out driving around and I heard you, and I just have to call. Carl Sandburg and his wife and his children lived in Harbert, Michigan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he often went on lecture tours hoping to raise money to live on, and his wife gave up her writing career, which was wonderful. She was a wonderful writer. To help support him, they had a goat farm, and she took care of everything so that he could write. And my mother and father had an art school in Detroit, Michigan, and often, well, every so often would entertain people. And she read to me from the time I was just a baby from Carl Sandburg, and his Rutabaga stories are wonderful. Parents, talking about teachers, read to your children, and those wonderful stories from the Rutabaga stories are poetry in themselves. The rhythm of his speech was wonderful, and he visited us at our studio after several of his lectures. And I was a very small child at the time, and my mother tried to get me to play some of my compositions on a little three-octave SD organ that we had, and he could see that I was just miserable. I was hiding behind a chair, and he was up toward the front of the room under one of the some of the lights that we used to spotlight the paintings, and he was playing his guitar, and his white hair fell over his forehead, and he looked right at me with this burning gaze and sang one of the folk songs about, when you're mad. He could see I was very disturbed, so he sang this song right to me about when you're mad and you're, I can't remember the words right now, but feeling helpless, you've got a stamp on your hat and your toothbrush and anything that's helpless.
All right.
He had such a rhythm to his voice. His speaking voice was poetry, too.
Oh, Joanna, thank you so much for your call. It's wonderful to bring Carl Sandburg to live for us tonight, or alive for us tonight. Thank you so much for your call. Thank you, everybody who's called tonight. We've heard from so many wonderful people.
Yes, and so many we couldn't hear from, so thanks a lot for calling. Greg up in Interlochen had just mentioned James Wright. I want to read three lines of James Wright about football. The fathers can't do one thing, the mothers can't do the other thing, and James Wright says at the end of this poem, Autumn begins in Martins Ferry, Ohio, "Therefore, their sons grow suicidally beautiful at the beginning of October and gallop terribly against each other's bodies." Different from the cities, but a wonderful poem.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Storylines Midwest. For more information on Storylines Midwest or the books we're reading, you can visit our website. That's storylines.ala.org, or you can check out your local public library. Participating libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and our discussion guides.
Storylines Midwest is produced by Tamar Charney. Our engineer is Bob Skahn.
We had production help from Rebecca Williams, Amanda McWhorter, and Allison Zatorsky.
Our library discussion guides were written by David Long. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries.
The executive producer of Storylines America is Paul Zalis.
Storylines Midwest comes to you from the studios of Michigan Radio at the University of Michigan. I'm Keith Taylor.
And I'm Charity Nebbe. Thanks for listening.
Storylines Midwest is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and Barnes & Noble Booksellers.
In 1967, race riots erupted in the city of Detroit. The National Guard moved in, and war raged on city streets.
Joyce Carol Oates was living in Detroit at the time, and her novel, Them, chronicles the period leading up to the riots. We'll have a conversation with Joyce Carol Oates next time on Storylines Midwest.